Welcome to The Crossroads. I am Ulises Rodriguez. I'm a PhD student in philosophy and cognitive science. And I have with me today my friend Shimon Stelter, or should I say Dr. Shimon Stelter. I watched your recent interview with Choose Agape and you were introduced as Dr. Shimon
Stelter. Well, technically I have a PhD, but so I should call you doctor. I don't use my doctor title everywhere.
This is one of the highest qualified people that have come through, through the podcast. So today we have what I think is going to be one of the most challenging podcast episodes I have recorded, not least because we have a Spaniard trying to speak in English, a Pole trying to speak in English, but also because we are going to be talking about the theory of evolution, some aspects of evolutionary biology that are relevant to the debate, science and religion. We hear a lot about the incompatibility between science and religion, or about the harmony that exists between science and religion, but we don't hear so often about practical cases of what this means. When we look at specific aspects of science that might seem to be in conflict with religion.
Yes, that's right.
It's not so common. So the goal of today's podcast is to actually offer a practical case of what it would be like for two believers to try to seek understanding at the forefront, at the interface between science and religion, especially in the aspect of evolutionary thinking. We are going to have an interactive, cooperative conversation, more than an interview, right? It would be interesting for us to try to explore some of those points of tension or areas that would seem to be in conflict with Catholicism, but that actually aren't in conflict with Catholicism. Before we begin, could you tell us a little bit about your work, what you do professionally on a daily basis? Because your background is not evolutionary biology per se, right?
Yes, that's right. I did my I studied at university biotechnology, which focuses mostly on cell biology, molecular biology, and I did have a course on molecular evolution too, although that was back in 2010, and since then there's been a lot of new developments in the field, so I had to catch up on them independently, because as you mentioned, I don't really do work with evolutionary theory on a daily basis, because first of all, I'm not an academic anymore. After my PhD, I moved to industry, working in biopharmaceutical companies producing that focus on making biological drugs. So we use organisms, simple organisms, to produce human antibodies for different indications. But I'm mostly an antibody engineer, so I try to tweak these antibodies, improve them. So I work in the early stage discovery process. My PhD was actually quite interesting, because that was back in London a few years ago, where I had a very interesting project. We tried to make human antibodies in tobacco plants. Tobacco plants, yes.
Okay. You tried to make human antibodies from tobacco plants.
Well, so my university is St. George's University in London, which is based in a hospital. And there's a hospital and a university. And on the rooftop, we have a greenhouse and we grow tobacco plants. We are modifying plants so they could make human antibodies. And we're purifying these antibodies. And I was then testing them, how these antibodies made in plants can be recognized by our immune system. Just to clarify, plants don't make antibodies themselves. Right. It's really just inserting the genes, human genes, into the plants and tricking the plant cell to express this as a protein. So we treated the plant as a bioreactor, a living bioreactor, just to actually make this antibody for us. Because you can't synthesize it chemically, it's too complicated. You need a cellular machinery to make a protein drug.
Mm-hmm. Bioreacted would be something like the field where you sow these antibodies, so to say, to reap them later. So what you want to do is to have the plants have a positive response to these antibodies so that they can produce them human antibodies. Does this make any sense? I'm giving you the response of the layperson that hears this, right? Like, basically you're saying that you're taking tobacco plants and trying to harvest human antibody cells.
Yes, so maybe the best way to explain is to give a little bit of a background, not too much, but in general, drugs that we make are chemical drugs. They can be synthesized in a tube, you know, by chemical reactions. They're very simple, usually chemical constructs. When it comes to biological drugs, like proteins, there are very complex molecules that, you know, are composed of amino acids that they need to be folded in a special way in a certain 3D structure to be functional, like every other protein. These can only be made within a cell, you know, using all the cell machinery, right? What's interesting, because all organisms share the same DNA code, you can take the human gene, part of DNA that codes the human antibody, and you can insert it into the DNA of a plant, and the plant will read it as its own protein and it will make a human antibody inside the cell. And then you can break this cell and you can extract the antibody from the cell. So you just use the cell machinery to produce this antibody, right?
Yesterday, you were mentioning the distinction between the wet lab and the dry lab, which I thought was quite interesting. So you are a wet lab kind of scientist.
Yes, I get my hands dirty.
You get your hands dirty. Wet in the sense of you actually get to work with actual...
Actual cells.
Materials. The scientist who is in the lab with...
Exactly. So we perform experiments in vitro and in vivo, whereas dry lab is mostly like in silico, so using computer programs. And
so in vitro would be on the actual glass?
Yes, in the glass, so in the tube, right?
The tube,
so
right.
Or be on a plate or whatever. In vivo is using actual living full organisms, right? Like mice, monkeys.
Okay, the actual. Yeah. And then in silico is on the computer.
That's right.
That's the idea. Okay, good. Okay, so we could say that the idea for today's podcast is connected to something that came up in your interview with Choose Agape with Catherine, mm-hmm. Who said to you that she, being a secondary school teacher, if I remember correctly, she's an RE teacher, and she gets questions about, I love the way she put it, like, Miss, but why do we have to believe what Genesis says if we know that, you know, science has disproved this and the theory of evolution tells us that Genesis is not true and things like that? And then her question to them is, well, do you actually, like, okay, yeah, fine, good, theory of evolution, but what's the theory of evolution? What do you understand by the theory of evolution? And then some of them don't know how to actually flesh out the main ideas of the theory of evolution. So not that I can do much better. So I am in a way putting this forward so that we can outline the main ideas that make up what we call the theory of evolution before we can actually talk about compatibility or incompatibility.
Oh yes, absolutely. I can't agree more, because what you find is that everyone talks about evolution, everyone heard of it, but and people, I think, have a general idea how it works, when it gets to actual mechanisms, there are a lot of misunderstandings or presumptions that are not quite correct, you know, and I think it's very useful to clarify that. I read some statistics the other day that about one-third of people in Europe, in each country, doesn't quite know what to believe about evolution, right?
Interesting.
And it's regardless of how religious the country is. So we'll be happy to... I think we should definitely start with kind of laying down just the basics of how evolution actually works and how it doesn't work.
It's remarkable that it has such a low level of acceptance as compared to the theory of gravitation or all the scientific theories, right? Evolution seems to be still a contested topic. There's loads of research done on this point on why it has such a low level of acceptance. And one thing, just to get us started, I think in my reading about this topic, some of the two common misconceptions that often come up or are pointed out that people often have are that, on the one hand, we tend to think of evolution as a linear development. Mm-hmm. So basically this picture of a series of monkeys standing more and more straight until you get to the human being, and then sometimes you get the image that ends with the human being again crouching in front of a computer or something like that.
Very classic. Everyone's seen this meme, I guess.
Yeah, right. So there's this idea that evolution is linear. That would be one of the aspects. And aspect number two would be that we, as part of evolution, are descended from monkeys that you can study in somewhere in Africa today, right? That our evolution, so human evolution, is from some today existing species of monkey.
Yes.
Do you want to say something to
this? Sure. As some people would put it maybe differently, they would say, oh, I understand how species can change within the kind, but Shimon, really, can a butterfly become an elephant? That's what someone asked me once, right? So this is quite similar. You're right. So this is one of the most prevalent misconceptions. People say that humans derive from monkeys, which technically is not true. What we should say is that monkeys and humans have a common ancestor. And this is actually quite different, because if the common ancestor was more similar to humans than to monkeys, then you could equally say that monkeys descend from humans.
Exactly.
In the same way, you've got dogs and cats that are related to each other, but it's not like dogs derive from cats or cats derive from dogs. Both of them have a common ancestor, which wasn't either of the two, really. Mm-hmm. So this is one thing when it comes to the linearity, if you think about it.
So one idea would be that evolution branches out like a tree, even though this is an imperfect image and it has problems with it, but better than the idea of a line where each species follows the next. What you have is a certain development in different directions, as if there is a certain specialization or a certain mm-hmm. Development of specific traits in different species, and then some of those branches of the tree continue into the future, some don't continue into the future. So the ones that you have today, like chimpanzees, mm-hmm. Bonobos, human beings, are not actually species that have evolved one from the other, but rather mm-hmm. they come from a previous trunk, from a previous stem in the tree, which is no longer extant. So rather than this linear development, what we have is instead the common ancestors. And this idea, which is very often you find it in evolution textbooks, right? The, mm-hmm. the trees and how the different species derive from previous ones. The problem is that you can rearrange these branches in different ways. So it's not just like a tree, but you can actually, depending on the evidence that you have, you can rearrange them in different manners.
Yeah, just to add on to what you're saying, I think it's important to make a distinction, which is also probably another misconception, that evolution happens at the level of an individual, right? So is this individual animal that changes and becomes something else?
Like Pokemon.
Exactly.
Did evolution. You ever play Pokemon?
Of course I did.
That was one of my favorite games that I had growing up. I have to say, I love Pokemon. So you have Charmander that becomes Charmeleon.
Oh, you must remember the name. I'm very impressed.
Yes, I do remember that. Okay, sorry, I stopped you. So not individuals, but populations. What does this?
It's populations. And it's a critical difference, because what happens when you talk about evolution, we think about populations. So first of all, you have a population of individuals of certain species, right? And within that, you've got quite enormous variation, really. People don't realize it. A lot of this variation is actually hidden because it's in the genes and sometimes they don't show, right? So you have this population, right, that is quite diverse. And there are different environmental forces that act on this population. And they can select which of these individuals will pass their genes and which won't, right? When you have a situation that a population splits for any reasons, can be geographical, right? Formation of an island fishes in the lakes and dropping of the lower levels, and you end up with two lakes, and you got split of the population. We have different environmental forces acting on these separate populations, and then they will diverge into different directions because different genes will be selected, different mutations, right? And then at some point, these populations might become different enough that they can no longer breed with each other, mm-hmm. Or way they breed, the offspring is infertile, right? So this can eventually, in a long time, lead to speciation. So these two populations can become two different species, right? So this is how evolution progresses. At the level of population, it's not like single individuals mm-hmm. changing. That makes sense.
The makeup. Yeah, it makes sense. Because in order to have evolution, you need to have reproduction in the first place. So the key element is how different individuals. I don't know if that's a good way of putting it, but I mean in the sense of we're not talking about individuals, but we're talking about, at the very least, interactions between individuals, because otherwise you can't have the whole dynamics that set evolution going, right? That's the basics of it. I should say, I haven't mentioned it yet, but we are presupposing the very basic truth, maybe it's too strong a word, or evidence for evolution. We're not going to discuss in great detail whether evolution is something that one should adhere to or not, because there's plenty of material in the internet about that. I think it's probably more interesting to get into the actual current research that is being done on that front, and we are going to just presuppose that there is a wealth of evidence for what is called the theory of evolution, with the theory meaning in the technical sense that it is a body of scientific knowledge that is backed by a number of observations that make it, if not conclusively true, at least highly likely. Okay, so another way of talking about the main pillars of the theory of evolution, I think, is to take it from a historical perspective, to set things into context for those listening, especially. When one thinks about the very contentious statements made sometimes by evolutionary biologists, and I'm thinking of Edward Wilson, who is, I think, a key example of when evolutionary thinking seems to come into conflict with not just with religious theories, but with a lot of what the humanities would say in terms of art, politics, things like that. Wilson is known to be one of the fathers of social biology, what is called social biology, which attempted to be an explanation of all aspects of human behavior, so including, you know, like artistic behavior or political behavior, moral behavior, religious behavior, in terms of genetics and molecular biology. This is a project that started in the 1950s, right? And it has a long story of controversy with it. It then morphed into evolutionary psychology, which is another developing field today, which is again very contentious for its attempts to import evolutionary thinking into psychology and psychological explanations. It's a really fascinating topic that we don't have time to go into. But this period of the 1950s onwards is what is called, or is known as, the modern synthesis in evolutionary biology. So this, I'd like the listener to get to take this, to keep this in mind as the point of reference, right? The modern synthesis is the point when evolutionary thinking becomes wedded to the rising molecular biology, which is experiencing very strong developments in this time, with the discovery of the structure of the DNA and the decoding of human genome towards the end of the 20th century. Right. So in order to provide a more understandable, coherent account, we're going to take it historically to explain how the modern synthesis arises, and then to talk about what developments are taking place today that seem to be suggesting that aspects of the modern synthesis need to be modified.
Or revised, yes, that's right.
I think that's a good way of...
Yes, that's a good point, actually, because many people think that theory of evolution is just like, okay, this is the theory and it's kind of done, we all know about it, but it's something that's been developing from, you know, back into 19th century all the way till now, and it's still being tweaked and worked at. So there's kind of this evolution of this evolutionary theory that's happening.
You were telling me that in the last 5 years, right? Because you were telling me that you've had to do a lot of catching up in your work, in your current job, in order to keep up with all the recent developments in, well, genetics, not just evolutionary biology.
Yes, that's right. It's a bit of a side note, but the science of biology, it's progressing really fast. It's incredibly how fast it started to progress in the recent years. And the reason for that is, first of all, the development of technologies that allow you to do high throughput analyses. So we are able now to sequence entire genomes, sequence entire proteomes. So
explain to the layperson.
Protein is kind of all the protein within the cell, right? So you get multi-dimensional data that are interconnected in a very complex way that a human person just can't process. But with the development of computer powers and bioinformatics, we're able now to process all this information, and that leads to very, very rapid developments in biology. So yes, if you stop looking at what's going on, then you have to really catch up.
Yes, this is a tangent on the tangents, but something that I find fascinating interesting is that these developments in biology are very profoundly connected to developments in technology.
Absolutely.
In the last 30 years. So big data, the nanotechnology as well, that allows us to explore, well, to explore a whole new realm in a more empirical way, you would say. Also cognitive science. So there's what sometimes is called the nano-cogno-bio-info paradigm, which is a really ugly expression, I think, but meaning that the nanotechnological with biological or biotechnological plus the informational plus the cognitive scientistic back realms are being fused into these new possibilities of research. And that's very fascinating. So if we go to the origin of the theory of evolution, I mean, obviously the departure point is Darwin, although Darwin was preceded by a lot of reflection. It's not like everything started with Darwin.
People. Yes, exactly. He didn't start out of the context, right? Yeah, that's right.
Let me know what you think about this. So is it fair to characterize, I like to think of the basic tenets of evolution as two pillars. Mm-hmm. One being that we have, in the first place, the production of variety or variation, right? In every generation. This is like playing a game of cards. I don't know if it's a good metaphor. You shuffle the cards and then you deal a different hand to different players, right? And then that would be the step one. Some variation is created. Then step two would be of that variation, then the game takes place. And then some of the cards are actually the ones that will win the game, so to say, right? And others won't. But you have this two-step process, which is namely called, well, not genetic mutation, because that's one specific form of variation, but production of variation of different variants or traits, and then the selection of some of those, which will be selected via what's been called natural selection, because some of them are more fitted to survive, etc.
Most, yes. It's not the only process. But you're right. There are multiple processes that involve in the development of the variation, and there are multiple processes that decide, if you like, which of these variants move on. And natural selection is one of the strongest ones, but not the only one.
Mm-hmm. So would you say then that if we go to Darwin, historically speaking, more or less, right? Darwin is famous for having coined the idea of natural selection, right? Mm-hmm. So the variants are selected because some of those organisms are more fitted for their survival, to reproduce and to survive, right? Mm-hmm. But Darwin did not have a theory of the origin of these variation. So that is to say, Darwin didn't have an account of how the variation originated, but he hypothesized that there should be some mechanism that would explain the passing on of these traits. But then the key contribution of Darwin was the idea of natural selection. And even at Darwin's time, these possible mechanisms for the creation of variation were not just genetic mutation. Actually, that comes much later. So Darwin considered a wide range of possible ways of creating these variation.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we think about Darwin as like, you know, he figured it all out, and it's not quite right that he was right in proposing the fundamental idea of the theory of evolution, but he was wrong about a couple of things, and you know,
wow, that one was wrong.
I can't blame him, because it was at a time where we didn't know about DNA, we didn't know about genes. That these things came later in the 20th century. It wasn't until 1950s that we discovered the structure of the DNA, right? So he was wrong in two points. First, he thought that when you have two parents, and the offspring is a kind of like a midpoint, or like a blend of the two, right? Which is not how traits are being transmitted. And another thing he was wrong about is he assumed that the acquired characteristics, something that can, you know, happen during your lifetime, can be transmitted to your offspring, because he believed that the somatic cells, so cells that compose your body, they can kind of travel to the germ cells and transmit the acquired characteristics.
So just to clarify, sorry, that last point. So the idea that things that happen to the organism during its own life can be passed on to the next generation,
exactly,
which will later be denied and all that, right? But
yes,
Darwin believed
exactly.
this.
Yeah.
So the blending thing is like, so for example, if we look at flamingos today, which are pink, they are pink because in the past there were loads of white flamingos and red flamingos, and they started getting together, and then loads of pink flamingo babies started originating, and today it's balancing to some, I'm making a bit of fun of this, but the idea of the traits of the parents blend into like 50%, 50%, something like that,
something
right?
Like that, yeah.
So this was seen not to be correct. The next stage, so to say, we've talked about Darwin, is moving on from the late 19th century, early 20th century, in the gap that exists between Darwin and the 1950s, which we've called is the modern synthesis. Mm-hmm. There's a number of developments which are crucial to establishing the modern synthesis, which are the rediscovery of Mendel's theory of heredity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the rise of population genetics. Can you tell us a little bit of what happens in this period?
And I would add Weismann to the picture as well. He's quite important too, because he came up with something that's called a somatic and germline barrier. So the idea, first thing that he actually found out is meiotic division, to be precise. So this is a type of a cell division that creates gametes, right?
Like I'm very tempted to tell you to go to the blackboard at the background and start writing.
you can put some pictures.
I will put
some
video, yes,
maybe
put
that, if that's easier, right?
Yes. As we speak, yes.
Right. And then by understanding this process, it became clear that the that somatic cells don't contribute to the development of the gametes. So you've got something that's called a germline. So it's always the gametes that transmit or the DNA and the traits, right? So this so this is an important point, right? So to clarify the misunderstanding that acquired characteristics can be transmitted.
So there's like two types of cells. We have, loads of types of cells in our body, but there's one specific type of cell, which is the cell that is involved in reproduction,
yes.
Which is the one that splits. Well, yeah, the cells that merge mm-hmm. during reproduction to give rise to a new organism, right? That's a very specific kind of cell.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only that cell which passes on some traits to the next generation or genetic material to the next generation.
That's right.
All the other types of cells which are not involved in reproduction don't actually do this. And this distinction, which is Weismann's barrier,
mm-hmm.
Was first highlighted by him, therefore explaining that the other kinds of cells, whatever happens to them, so cells, mm-hmm. I suppose, that are specialized in nervous tissue
mm-hmm.
or,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, like digestion or whatever, whatever happens to them doesn't actually affect.
Yeah, yeah. So if you damage your stomach or something and you'll have like damaged cells and mutated cells in your stomach, right, then it's not like your offspring will then have a damaged stomach to start with because you had it damaged, right?
Okay. Makes sense. When did Weismann live around? That's late 19th
century.
So
his developments were early 19th century, 20th century, sorry.
Late 19th and early 20th.
And then you mentioned the rediscovery of Mendelian inheritance, right? Where Mendel kind of realized that the offspring isn't really a blend, like a midpoint between two parents, but it's just some traits are at least expressed or not expressed in the offspring, right?
So rather than white flamingos and red flamingos,
yes, you just have a different proportion of whites and reds, if you like.
Right. So you have, well, like you would have,
yeah.
So rather is that you have a pink trait, like a pink mm-hmm. flamingo mm-hmm. trait, and then say a white flamingo trait, and then they distribute in combination in different
yes.
Generations, right? Some are expressed, some aren't expressed. We were talking about baldness. Let's talk about this. Why not? Let's talk about this, right? Because you were telling me that baldness is a trait that is, as the Mendelian genetics would mm-hmm. explain, right? Can be inherited or not inherited. Because I was telling you, my parent, but my father is not bald, as uh-huh. far as I know, and neither is my grandfather. However, this is something that can be expressed even if previous generations don't have these traits, because you have a recessive gene that
yes,
lies
right.
dormant and then suddenly it's expressed later on.
Yes, it's...
Do you agree?
Yeah, so in this specific example, the idea is that you get one copy of the gene from your mother and one copy of your gene from your father, right? And then some variants of the genes are dominant, so you usually have that one expressed rather than the other. So one will be dominant and one will be recessive and will not express, right?
Could you give an example of I don't know, like one case of dominant and recessive.
Well, you're talking about baldness, right? So
we're going to stick to the example of baldness.
It's a little bit, it's a bit unusual, that one. It's a bit unusual in a way, but it's okay. We can take it. So if... Oh, gosh, then I need to mention that you're balding.
You can do it. I won't be offended. It's probably becoming obvious. It's not contagious, right? It's not because Abel is passing it on to me or anything.
I'm not sure if Abel is involved in this. This is awkward now. We kind of got into this point, so...
I wanted to add some colour to the conversation.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. So, if you're a balding, for example...
Just to give one random example.
Yeah. Without pointing anything. And none of your parents are balding. That would mean that your mother would have a dominant and a recessive trait. In women, it's actually expressed differently than in men. So it's a bit more complicated. So it's a bit more complicated than example. But if the women have both the dominant and recessive, they don't bald. Whereas in men, when you get one of the copy, you bald. Men do bald, right? Your dad is not balding, so he must have two recessive traits, right? So you must have passed one recessive to you. And then from your mother, you could have got the either for one for baldness or the one for hair. Mm-hmm. And you're, I think, unlucky to get the one for baldness.
I am unlucky to get the one for baldness. Okay.
So in that sense...
Sorry, bad luck. There's nothing you can do. That's about it. Okay.
Oh, anyway.
Okay, maybe can you give an example of a trait that is not baldness? Well, the example that Mendel himself gave or he experimented with...
To check this time precisely, because it was with the peas, right? Then it were like pink flowers and white flowers or something.
Well, I don't know. I mean, let's say that there are green peas and yellow peas, and that's the way they explain it. I mean, I'm going for a very basic explanation. I don't need to get all the details, but basically that he just discovered that if he bred different types of peas, as in yellow and green peas, you don't get a mixture of yellow and green, but what you get is that in some generations, mm-hmm. there's a distribution that some peas will be yellow, some peas will be green. And if you do the maths, mm-hmm. then you realize that there is a distribution that shows you that some genes are dominant. So they tend, mm-hmm. when they appear, when the, let's say that the green is the dominant, right? Mm-hmm. When the green appears with the yellow, the green is the one that will always be expressed.
Yes.
Whereas if you have yellow, yellow, it will always be yellow. Obviously, yeah. If you have green, green, it will be green. Therefore, yeah. The maths tell you. Something like that. That's the idea of Mendelian genetics. We don't need to get into...
You just explained it.
Okay. So, and this was largely unknown because Mendel, we have to say, was an obscure Augustinian monk in a monastery in Austria, right? And his work didn't really... His work was rediscovered particularly at the beginning of the 20th century. I think it was a group of mathematicians. John Fisher is one of them, I think he was called, who were doing... mathematical models to study not just the distribution of peas, like a culture of peas, but actually large population, and that became mm-hmm. population genetics. I don't know, but basically Darwin didn't have a story of how inheritance is passed on, mm-hmm. and it was later discovered through Mendelian genetics that this would be the way that it worked. And then we get to the 1950s or to the 1940s, 1950s, the modern synthesis, which brings all of this together.
Exactly. So it brings Darwinian ideas, Mendelian genetics, and Weizmann cell divisions and inheritance, right? So all together, and we get a bit of bigger picture of how evolution works.
At what point did it? Yeah, because as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm probably wrong, so I need to be corrected.
I think it was 30s, but I'm not sure.
30s. But the idea in the modern synthesis that the main mechanism of evolution, as I understand it, right? The main idea mm-hmm. of the modern synthesis is that the main mechanism of evolution is genetic mutation. Mm-hmm. So that is to say, from one generation to the next, the variation that you see in traits mm-hmm. comes about through mutations in the genes, mm-hmm. and then it is the the selection of the environment over the different variants that gives rise to evolution. So that is to say, in every generation of flamingos, sorry to say the example of flamingos, every generation of flamingos,
balding flamingos,
they have different traits. And then because they live in a particular environment, some will survive, some will not survive, and those that survive will be the ones that pass on their genetic material to the next generation. And there's no influence from what happens during the lifetime of the flamingo on the genetic material that is passed on. So the key agent in this story are the genes. This is the idea that it's the genes that do all the work of carrying evolution forward. And as far as I understand, this idea has attracted some criticism towards the end of the, not towards the end of the 20th century, but in the 21st century, actually, saying that this is not the whole picture, we should complement it, and some of these changes are very interesting and relevant. I don't know if you think this characterization of the modern synthesis seems fair to you, because this is standard genetics. I think every geneticist studies these story, and the criticisms to the main story told in the modern synthesis are something very recent. So maybe what I'm saying to you doesn't sound like, I don't know, shocking, but like basic genetic textbook science, right? I don't know. What do you think? Is this something like completely alien to your experience of genetics? I'm speaking from the point of view of the history of biology.
I mean, this is a big part of how evolution comes about, if you like. And maybe it's useful to break it down a little bit, right? So we talked a lot about how different variants appear, right? And one you mentioned quite a lot is the mutations in the DNA. But that's not the only way that different variants come about. There are other processes like horizontal gene transfers, that there is genes that can be transferred from one species across to another species. That happens more often in bacteria, for example. Yeah, so then you have a new variant appearing where it gets some DNA from another species.
How does this happen? Because there's no...
It's called a horizontal gene transfer.
But it's not through any kind of reproduction between two different species?
Not really, no. It often goes through what we call plasmids. These are a circle or small fragments of DNA that can carry... some traits, like, I don't know, antibiotic resistance, for example, can be passed on to another species. So horizontal gene transfer. Other things are transposons, for example, or that on our genome, we think about genome as something really stable, but are elements that are movable and under certain circumstances, environmental circumstances, they can be induced and they can be moved to a different place in the genome, and they can disrupt the... another gene, or they can change their expression, right? So it's not just a mutation in the DNA, it's just the rearrangement. Another rearrangement happens during the recombination. So we talked about meiosis and Weismann, right, earlier. So when we split the, during the meiosis, when the chromosomes split, and then each gamete will get one, before they split, often they exchange fragments. So you don't really get an entire perfect copy of your mother chromosome, but it's usually your mostly maternal chromosome with a part of your paternal one. So it's another recombination that can happen. So there are different ways that the variation can come about. And then when it comes to the selection, yes, there's environment and survival of the fittest. That's not the only way that variants can, different individuals with different variations can stay alive or die out. There can be things like, that's called the bottleneck phenomena, where usually it's quite a catastrophic event, that just by pure chance, a small sample of individuals will survive, right? And you will lose some of the variations, and some will get fixed, right? In that small population that will grow, the other individuals will grow out of it. And that's just really pure chance in that sense, right?
So like, for example, you have a population of, let's not say flamingos, what animal?
I mean, an ideal example... that's mostly on the macroevolution level, because I wanted to bring out dinosaurs and mammals. But within the population, And it can be a flood, it can be anything.
With a population of reptiles or whatever.
Yes, on a certain island or whatever. Mm-hmm.
And then only some of them will survive.
Will survive. Or a fire, right, mm-hmm. Happen in the forest and can reduce the population quite dramatically. And it will be just some individuals that survive. So some variations will be lost. But it's not because those that survive, it's not because they're the most adapted to the environment. It's just happened in a catastrophic event that somewhere.
Exactly. So and adaptation is not the only.
No, not the only one, right? So the different drivers of evolution, this genetic drift, so which usually happens in small populations, just because the traits are randomly distributed, if you like.
Like the color shuffled.
Yeah, a little bit to the next generation. If a small population, some of these variants might be lost just by pure chance, by just reshuffling, right? That's called genetic drift. So there are different mechanisms within modern synthesis of how variation comes about and how different variants get selected, if you like, or mm-hmm. survive. Another thing you've mentioned that scientists were getting really excited about the discovery of DNA, right? And then how we can just then later on map our genome mm-hmm. and then basically have like a map of instructions and find, you know, new drugs and understand, you know, almost predict what's going to happen in your life just looking at your genes. But one of the major surprises that came from the Human Genome Project was how few genes we actually have. So okay. In our human genome, there is less than 30,000 genes, which is very little. If the idea that was at that point, as we understood that each gene coded for a protein, or an RNA sometimes, or mostly for a protein, and that protein had a certain function, right? And we know that we have a lot of proteins, antibodies themselves. Mm-hmm. There's loads of different antibodies we can make, you know, there's like billions variants we can have of antibodies.
Right, so the number of proteins and antibodies is much larger.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why do we have only 30,000 genes, mm-hmm. right? So that was one of the surprises that came from the human genome. So it became very clear that it's not all genes, it must be something else.
Can you give us a little context for the Human Genome Project, when it more or less around which time began, when it...
Because it began in the 90s, and the first draft wasn't published until April 2003,
I think. So very recent, during our lifetimes.
Certainly. Yeah.
Okay, so moving on a little bit, we come to what I've mentioned have been some of the criticisms of the modern synthesis in very recent years. Now, I'm not an evolutionary biologist, and I don't think this is exactly your expertise, mm-hmm. so we don't have mm-hmm. to go very deep into it. But there have been a number of criticisms coming from different areas of biology to what seem to be a too genetics-based biology. Mm-hmm. And I understand this is what is called the extended synthesis, mm-hmm. The idea that the synthesis needs to be reshaped, reframed, restructured in some way. Some people are making claims to a very radical revision of the theory of evolution. Other people are making a bit more moderate claims, and other people are saying, no, the theory of evolution doesn't need to have any changes made to it, because mm-hmm. These criticisms can be absorbed very easily into the original theory.
Mm-hmm. It's more like the phenomena that we observe now, that we study, can be either interpreted within the model synthesis model, or can actually challenge the model, and then some scientists claim that we need to change the framework. It's more about how important these phenomena are in driving evolutions rather than being an effect of evolution, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah. What kind of phenomena are you thinking of?
So there are usually... So people who propose the extended synthesis, they flag four different areas which they think don't... They deserve much attention, right? And that they should be accounted for as drivers for evolutions. They are extra genetic, as you say, right? So two of them will be around development, organismal development, which are developmental bias and developmental plasticity. And the other two are niche construction extra genetic inheritance. So just to give you maybe some examples of these within developmental plasticity, the idea is that as organisms grow and they respond to the environment, right? You've got this interplay between the organism and environment and how it changes the organism's development. So it's not like the genes have the structures, like, you know, an IKEA booklet that you just assemble the wardrobe perfectly to the instructions. It's more that as the organism develops, for example, it builds its blood vessels. They are built around the under the pressure of oxygen, the lack of oxygen, as a response to the lack of oxygen, right? Or trees that are living in some windy conditions, they have these funny shapes, right? Mm-hmm. So this shape is not determined by the gene.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
These are all determined by the interaction of the organism with the with environment. So there's kind of certain developmental plasticity of organisms. Another example from human biology is puberty, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not like we have a very contentious subject nowadays.
Bringing up all the main topics.
No, it's more that the moment of puberty will it's not strictly genetically determined either. I mean, of course, it is to a certain extent, but the other factors that can either delay the process or bring it forward, right?
Of puberty.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And that creates fixed changes in the characters, right?
But how would that affect evolution, though?
Exactly. So these are good questions, right? Maybe I'll give a few more examples about the extended synthesis. So these are developmental plasticity. Some examples for niche construction is something that we talked about as well. The beavers making dams and basically organisms adapting the environment. And that way putting a pressure on themselves, but also on other organisms around, right? So scientists who propose the extended synthesis would say that the created environment has a different quality to the environment that's out there, you know, and that it should be treated differently. Qualitatively different, right? So it's not random in a sense, right? It's modified by the organism. But then those who are in favor of sticking to modern synthesis would say that they would call these developments an extended phenotype. So
an extended phenotype.
Phenotype, right? So of course, phenotype is what shows in your organism, right? So we talked about these flamingos before, right? Yes. So which color you actually get, you know?
Yeah. So the genotype would be the genetic material that you have, but yes. Not all of it is expressed. Some of it is expressed.
So those what shows up, these traits that show up, that's the phenotype, right?
Phenotype.
And within your, but then they would call it an extended phenotype, something outside of your organism, right? So these genes, it's genes determine that these beavers make these dams and. You know what I mean? But then again, the other has an argument that this is qualitatively different environmental pressure. But anyway, so this is another example. And the extra genetic inheritance, it's an interesting one, actually. Because if you look at the if you look at this, yes, we do inherit genes from our parents. We look at animals, not only human species. Like it's also other things that we get from them at the very early stage of our development. Things like microbiota. And we know now, there's a lot of research on how microbiota influences our gene expression. So the bacteria that we have in our guts, right? How they can affect even our mood. And they also provide us with the hormones or during the pregnancy, right? Antibodies by breastfeeding. And then you also acquire from our parents' culture aspects, like the animals as well, all the niche that they've created, they also inherit that. So you can have an animal, right, a genetic twin, and you would take it to a different group of animals, the same species somewhere else, and they would develop differently, even though they have the same genotype, right? Another important part of extra genetic inheritance is epigenetics, which we haven't talked about yet. So epigenetics is the field that deals with mostly gene expression. So how different genes are expressed at different times. Genes can be switched off or switched on, activated, slowed down. And these are modifications of histones, which are proteins that are they stick to DNA, is wrapped around histones, right? So modifications of these or the modifications of DNA itself, like little tags. You can think about as tags, right?
Okay. And so, for example, like the people usually say, alcoholism. So you have a that's a typical example. Uh-huh. You can have the gene, the trait of a tendency to develop alcoholism, but it doesn't mean that you will develop it because there's a difference. There's a distance to be traveled between having the gene and actually expressing it.
Yeah,
it's an example.
Exactly. And these tags can be modified by the environment. So as the organism is developed, you know, and then this can be some of them can be passed, some cannot be passed on. So there's some extra genetic inheritance involved too. So we can see that the picture is much, much, much more complicated. It's not just genes that we get from your parents. It's more than that.
More than that. And we get into the very interesting then field, which is what I like. So all of this that you have said is a number of factors that would affect the process of evolution, saying that evolution does not come down only to the genes and even genetic recombination, but actually there are also, among the ones you've mentioned, environmental factors. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I personally find very interesting because it means that culture, and I don't mean just human culture, but also animal culture in the sense of the way animals modify their own environment, their own ecosystems, actually
the social behaviors and so on,
in the evolutionary trajectory can have an impact, right?
Mm-hmm.
And importantly, I think this is one of the key ideas of the extended evolutionary synthesis. Synthesis. That if the changes that a species makes to the environment are lasting enough, stable enough, then they will be inherited and passed on to the next generation. Therefore, saying that it is not only the genetic, not only the Weismann barrier, where only the genetic material through the germ cells is passed on to the next generation, but actually the environment and what an organism does during its lifetime can have an impact on the evolutionary trajectory. Mm-hmm. This seems to contradict the established doctrine of, at least of the Weismann barrier and the modern synthesis, that what the acquired traits are not passed on to the following generations. I find this interesting for a very simple reason, that it places the agency of the organism at the center. And I think that's interesting. One might be tempted to reduce the whole evolutionary mechanism to genetics and to the molecular level, and therefore deny the capacity of the organism, and particularly of the human species, of actually doing anything. Everything is determined, and this is why I spoke of determinism before, is determined from the genetic molecular level up. And that's the whole story you have to tell. Mm-hmm. Human culture becomes a mere icing on the cake. You don't actually need to take it into account. It has no causal power or agency at all. But these revisions or potential seeming revisions to classical evolutionary theory seem to be suggesting that organisms have an agency and they play a role in their own makeup, in their own morphology, in their own evolution. And therefore, that we shouldn't just consider the genes as the vehicles of evolution, which is Richard Dawkins' way of conceptualizing it, but actually we should look at what the organisms do and at ecology and behavioral biology, primatology, for example, for the study of human conduct and all these things. And therefore, there's a much wider field where biology should not be just reduced to genetics, as I'm saying, but you could take into account even human culture as a factor in all of this. Mm-hmm. Although I wrote a paper on philosophy of biology last term, and I was raising the question, does human culture play a causal role in evolution?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the lecturers that corrected the paper, who is a very well-respected and known biologist who's worked on the origins of life and knows very, all of the dynamics very well, said to me, I'm sorry, but it just doesn't work. Like, you're not very positive about it. I send you a greetings, Kepa, if you're watching this. But, thank you for your correction, your feedback. But it's much debated. I mean, I'm saying this very tentatively because it's a wild claim to say that animal culture of any kind plays a role in evolution, because this is a very well-established theory, and these are very recent criticisms or adjustments being made to the theory.
Like more like propositions, I'd say.
What do you think about?
Oof, I don't have an opinion on that, to be honest. I'm not an evolutionary biologist myself, and I'm not part of the academic milieu that meets up at the conferences and discusses these ideas. I'm a little bit disconnected from all of that. I'm reading the literature, so I come across these ideas. And as you say, I'm not definitely not a person to make a judgment. What I found interesting, though, as I was reading about the some of the ideas presented by the scientists in favor of extended synthesis, like in my mind, I would always reframe them naturally in the framework of modern synthesis, and I found like, okay, they give me examples, but like I don't quite understand them, and I realize that I don't understand them because I immediately see them in the light of modern synthesis, right? So I always tend to go back to the gene at the end of the day. These are challenging ideas, but I can see that, you know, they make a point, and it'll be interesting to see how this develops further as new research is being presented, and whether the ideas have a predictive power.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then we go into the last section of the things that I wanted to discuss. We'll see if more come up, but I've just mentioned determinism,
mm-hmm.
right? So something that one could say is a philosophical proposition, not just a biological proposition. So that's the idea that events are... the chain of causal events in the world is necessitated, is necessary, and there's no such thing as, well, I can say, human freedom, for example, right? Mm-hmm. This is explicit in the works of people like Edward Wilson, mm-hmm. who would say that, maybe I'm being unfair to Wilson, I don't know, because I haven't read the whole of his work, but maybe he qualified his claims later on, but the idea that thanks to molecular biology, we're going to be able to explain human morality away, right? And people who use these kinds of biological theories to say, well, we have explained freedom away. There's no such mm-hmm. thing as human mm-hmm. freedom, for example. This is one concrete example. You are a Catholic biologist, right? So somebody who works...
I'm a Catholic, I'm a biologist. I'm not a Catholic biologist.
As I was saying, that's quite a strange thing to say, a Catholic and a biologist, among many other things. But how would you... I mean, feel challenged in some way by you saying that your thinking is still very much rooted in the modern synthesis,
mm-hmm.
Would you think that it follows from the modern synthesis or genetics that we don't have free will because we are determined by our genes, for example?
Well, you're now blending science, biology with philosophy. So, you know, there's this fine balance when you need to think when you're making scientific statements, when you're making philosophical statements. Like, biology never really showed that there's no human free will or something like that. And it can't, because it's outside of the scope of the empirical research.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, so you're making a distinction between philosophy or pronouncements in a philosophical realm and then biology or more scientific mm-hmm. Realm. That's disputed. There are people who just don't, would not agree. I mean, it's known by everyone that people like Richard Dawkins mm-hmm. often would say, I do science, I don't do, you know, mumbo-jumbo philosophy or whatever, because he does think that the truth is exclusively reduced to the sciences. So mm-hmm. this is very much connected to certain trends in philosophy. You have, obviously, a tradition of positivism, or what is called positivism,
mm-hmm.
which would deny the truth value of any discipline outside empirical science, for mm-hmm. example. Mm-hmm. This mm-hmm. comes from the early 20th century, very mm-hmm. powerful and influential way of thinking, right, about science. But there are people who would say, well, no, because as a scientist, you do need to have some philosophical training, because during your own study and your own research as a scientist, you come up with philosophical questions, and unless you are prepared, you have some philosophical training to tackle these questions, you will not be, you will be making some muddy claims that don't stand, don't withstand the examination of philosophers.
Well, I think in order to do science, strictly speaking, you do not need philosophy directly, but maybe to interpret some data. But even that, it's just you interpret it within certain scientific framework. So it's just science, it's a scientific work. I guess that you can build your worldview using your experiences or your understanding of the world. And of course, you bring on your scientific knowledge, and then you can make some claims, like you've mentioned Dawkins, that, you know, anything outside science can't provide truth. But the claim that he makes is not a scientific claim any longer. It's a philosophical claim, and, you know, it's basically scientism, right? It's only science can provide truth. Which, you know, then we can talk whether scientism is true or not, but then again, you can't prove it in the lab. Then you just, you, by necessity, you're having a philosophical discussion. The problem with many scientists, I find, is that with looking within my colleagues back at the university, I had a situation where we did have a philosophy course, but it was very short. It was only half a year, and then bioethics another half a year. And the vast majority of students in my year, they laughed at it. They was like, "Oh no, you know, we are here to study biotechnology. Like, you know, we should be doing molecular biology, biochemistry. All the other things are irrelevant, are important. I'm not gonna have, you know, an elderly lady telling me what to do, what not to do, you know, doing catechesis." And even though bioethics was so much far from it, it was presenting different ideas rather than telling you which one is right, which one is not, which shows you that certain contempt of scientists towards philosophy in a way. And we don't really get philosophical training much. As I say, there's only this course. I don't think that was enough. And if you think about it, you train people to modify DNA, which is really easy now. And but you don't teach them bioethics, really, all these ideas. So it's a bit tricky situation to be in. And that's why many scientists start making philosophical claims without realizing that they're actually making a philosophical claim, not a scientific claim, because they draw their philosophical conclusions on the scientific understanding of the world. They think that they're still making science, but, you know, they cross that line when they're no longer doing science. They're doing philosophy without knowing it, at least. And that's the dangerous point, right? You can make these claims as long as you're aware what you're doing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, to play devil's advocate a little bit, we are handling a distinction between the line that runs between science and philosophy. So the idea that you should distinguish between both of them, and scientists need philosophical training as well. Also, the idea that which is repeated often in many of these discussions, that science studies the natural realm, or that which can be, you know, studied empirically, or similar variation of that claim, and then you have, you know, something else, which is philosophy or whatever.
Metaphysical
claims, for example. But I think my thinking about this is, well, many scientists who don't have any kind of transcendent framework, because I do believe that there is a certain continuity, right, between the science and the philosophy.
Of course it is. Even science is stemmed from natural philosophy, right?
It's based on metaphysics and things like that, right?
Yes.
Well, my idea is that you finish your work as a scientist, you get back home at the end of the day, and then it's not like you've stopped thinking, because you're a human being, and science is made by human beings just as philosophy is made by human beings. And there are existential, profound questions that affect us all. And I think there's some, so it's very difficult for a person who's a non-believer, I would say, this is a generalization, but who, not to be tempted to build a system of philosophy on the basis of the science that he's researched. I'm thinking of Richard Dawkins, right? You have some science and then you extend it a little bit because you think your science is sufficient to push it into the philosophical realm, even without philosophical training, which is quite a daring thing to do.
Yeah, because you end up doing bad philosophy in that sense, yeah.
I think one key example of this in regard to the theory of evolution is the whole discussion of chance, necessity, contingency, and all that. Because it was often used as an argument, and we're moving into the realm of possible points of tension with a religious worldview, in conflict with the idea that the world was created by a benevolent God that willed it to be, and that we are here for a purpose, because often it is claimed. Well, evolution shows to us that we are products of chance, that there's no such thing as you know, directional design in nature, and therefore, you know, there's no will that can be discerned behind this. It's just a chanceful process.
Exactly. So it's a question of teleology and randomness, right? Well, a couple of points I can maybe make here. So when biologists make a claim that that the evolutionary process is random, if you like, or things happen by chance, then you have to ask yourself, what do you mean by random, right? Because randomness, in a strictly mathematical sense, so that one of the drivers of the evolution is mutations, right? So in a strictly mathematical sense, randomness would be that within your genome, you've got a string of DNA, right? This is your genome. And then each of the nucleotides would have equal chance of being mutated and modified, right?
So chance as equal possibility in all directions.
Randomness
equal in the probability in all directions.
Yeah, in the strictly mathematical sense. Mm-hmm. So well, we know this is not true, right? There's certain areas in the genus that are more likely to be mutated, and some that are less likely to be mutated. So this is like from the mathematical point of view. What they mean is kind of biological randomness. In by that sense is that the mutation that happens is either neutral or detrimental or beneficial. And that mutation happening, like, it's a kind of, it's not that it happens in order to be beneficial or detrimental.
And,
so
you're using evaluative language like beneficial and detrimental from the point of view of selection of variants.
Exactly, so and the current environmental pressure, right?
Which is already slightly teleological.
Yes, and then of course it brings the question of the teleology. So in terms of teleology, when we say that evolution is purposeless, it is purposeless, and there's no teleology in the sense that organisms do not change in order to adapt. It's not like they're trying to develop wings in order to fly and have that adaptive advantage. But it's more like that you've got these mutations that create variations, and you've got some that survive, some don't, right? So it's not like eagles have wings to fly. It's just eagles fly because they have wings. It's a kind of a bit different way of thinking in that sense. So this is what we mean by randomness and teleology, I guess, because again, I think I'm now doing philosophy.
Well, exactly.
From a biological point of view.
Exactly. That's what's interesting. There's such a thing as philosophy or biology, right? And and this is a teleology that is relative to the context. So it's
exactly
for the purposes of survival and reproduction. Yes. There's a bias towards A rather than B because one is more beneficial for the purposes of reproduction and survival and all that, right? So that's very interesting because that also brings to mind the different factors you were mentioning before about the extended synthesis that seem to show that there is a not a randomness but a biased process of selection of...
Yes, developmental bias, but also things like niche constructions, right? So these are kind of changes that are not random in a sense that the beavers change how they change the environment and how this affects the ecosystem around them.
I mean, I think this is also important because of the historical context where Darwin was writing. So we talked about this in a previous podcast episode with Professor Jaume Navarro, who came, and I was very impacted by the idea that, well, the context where the theory of evolution is first elaborated is the background of a mechanistic philosophy that develops with Newton and Galileo in the from the 17th century onwards. And it's this idea that the world is a set of interlocking causes, such that if you know the initial conditions of the universe, you could predict everything that is going to unfold, because there's no such thing as unpredictability or surprise, in the sense that we get through the laws of nature that we can describe, we can predict the outcomes of everything. If you pair this with the theology of a God that wills creates the world and is the one that sets the initial conditions, then you get this idea of the watchmaker God, which is the idea that was attacked time and again from downward onwards, right? Because it does seem that the only role that God plays in the world is to set these initial conditions, and then you set the whole thing off, and off you go, that's it, right? And then maybe he has to tweak the whole mechanism and all that. But what did the theory of evolution show, at least in the Darwinian theory of evolution? Well, that evolution sometimes is messy, it's not efficient, you know, it leads to dead ends, it creates a number of varieties, and there's a lot of wastefulness in what it does. And some of it seems to go nowhere, and then it explores unexpected. So all of this idea that seemed to contradict the perfect orderly God that has laid out all the different parts in nature, so that if you study nature, you are actually reading God's will in it. That's bad theology, I would say, from my side, right? Because there is an older theological tradition in classical theism, in Thomas Aquinas, for example, that says, well, God acts through contingent and necessary causes, right? So through both of them, and not least through human freedom. So in the Christian story, it is fundamental that our own freedom is not in competition or separate from God, but actually God does use our freedom. And our freedom wouldn't seem to be completely predictable from prior causes. There's something contingent about it. So my point being that contingency is a better term perhaps than randomness, in that it expresses that there are a number of outcomes that cannot always be predicted. And this is much more complicated. I mean, we won't get into a lot of detail, but the main point being that we do not necessarily believe in a watchmaker God who sets some initial conditions, but in a God that does act through what seems to be necessary and contingent factors.
Well, I don't think that the idea of the watchmaker is in any way correct or necessary. It can be even a stumbling block, because we kind of naturally tend to see design in nature, just because as children we're exposed to artifacts, so different objects that are designed for the purpose. And in this sense, organisms are not designed for the purpose, right? So I think maybe let's take a few steps back, because we kind of dive into the details. What we want to touch on here really is the possible points of conflicts, right, between the our religious understanding of the world and the scientific understanding of the world, right? And in that sense, what you can, if you look from the scientific perspective, from the evolutionary theory, you can see that, yes, okay, you don't like the word randomness, let's call it, or chance, let's call it, there is contingency. So there are things that, you know, went certain way, could have gone another way, right? And it was, in a sense, driven by chance, right? So the humans happen to evolve, but they equally could not have, right? And then from the Christian point of view, you were understanding that the world is created for us, right? That it's created so we can dwell upon the earth and so on. And then we are seen as a kind of a special creation that's almost separate from the other of the natural world, like being made in the image of God versus other creatures, right? And then if you look at it again from the evolutionary theory, you can say that, oh, we just merely other animals, really, right? And there are other humans as well, at some point, other human species and interbreeding as well. So, you know, in what sense, how can you reconcile this one view that seems to be driven more by chance, right, and randomness in a way, or contingency, if you say, or from the other side that can be that's very theological, right, that all that we are created for a purpose and so on. So I think this is where the potential clash is, and it's not like there is no good response for it, right? And as you mentioned, there are earlier traditions that could provide some insights how you can reconcile the two. And Thomas Aquinas' understanding of the secondary and primary causes, right? The God being a primary cause and holding everything in existence versus secondary causes of organisms acting in the world as a secondary cause, right? So this is one way that you can kind of, with these planes, if you like, can meet, where you can, then when things can happen under God's providence. Now, I need to be really careful here, because then, you know, these are a lot of nuances that need to be cleared up. Some people like to say, on one hand, you've got, oh, no, evolution is true, so, you know, Christianity is wrong, which is silly in a way. I mean, I understand where they're coming from, of course. On the other hand, you've got Catholics often saying, oh, you know, I don't see any issue at all. And it's like, God simply creates through evolution.
Yep.
And I'm like, well, okay. What do you mean by that, right? So people came up with some ideas like theistic evolution, right? That God kind of directs the process. And you have to be really careful what you mean by that. What we don't mean by that is something that is more similar to intelligent design, something that, you know, some creationists proposed, that you can, that God is not a force within the world.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right. That it's not like he's kind of pushing little blocks and helping the evolution, steering it, kind of. He's not like, you've got gravity, you've got environmental factors, and then you've got God that is acting within that plane as a necessary component, right? So we don't understand it that way, right? Some people say that God simply creates through evolution, and they make this claim of theistic evolution, which I really don't like the name for it, because there is nothing theistic about evolution or any biological process. You know, you don't talk about theistic reproduction or...
Right. Good point. Yeah, point.
Or, I don't know, theistic respiration or whatever, and you don't... So in a sense, evolution is a biological process like any other biological process, and it doesn't need the supernatural intervention to occur, right? We can even make it broader, right? In order for humans to be here on the Earth, like, the Earth had to be created, right? But nobody thinks about the planetary development as teleological, right? That, oh, the Earth was created for us to dwell in. So there's no theistic evolution, there's no theistic planetary formation.
Yeah, exactly.
People don't even come up with these ideas.
Theistic
there's
ufology.
Something about evolution particularly that it just wants us to invite God into this process, where there are all the other processes that are equally necessary for us to derive, that we don't even think of bringing God into that picture, right? Mm-hmm. And as we can see, some people may claim that, you know, the origins of life, yes, we don't really know. There are three major hypotheses how the life originated on the Earth. And they're all propositions. They're all, of course, naturalistic and biological, chemical, physical propositions. And then some people like to claim that maybe, you know, God had to create the first life, and then, you know, in a supernatural way, at least at this point. But if you think again, as as the universe developed, you know, there's no supernatural, we don't think that there was any supernatural intervention in the development of the early universe all the way to the creation of Earth. There is no supernatural intervention as it seems to be in the evolutionary process. So why would that particular point that links would need the supernatural? It looks like it makes sense that at this point would also be fully natural and naturalistic in a way.
Great
right?
point. Yeah.
So this creates a framework where you've got the natural world that is driven by the natural causes. Now, the question is, does this completely exclude God from the picture? Well, no, because things can work through divine providence. And when we think about randomness and contingency, maybe you see this, you explained it a bit better, contingency, we see contingency in our lives, you know, people that we meet, like the person, the spouse you end up with, you know, the stories, like people sometimes tell really crazy stories how they met up and how many different improbable components came together for this to happen, right? And they still have a feeling that, you know, it's supposed to be in a way, right? It's not the kind of predetermined mechanistic fatum, if you like, but it's still the understanding that you can have randomness and you can have a certain level of teleology. And then if you have a God who is outside of the natural world, so doesn't act as one of the causes, but the primary cause and acts through the secondary causes, this is how you can combine the two in a way. Does this make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. You're making great points. I think the first thing I would say is that, yes, the problem tends to be that we've reduced God to a little God that acts within the universe, mm-hmm. and we've raised evolution to a little God that is in competition with God. And therefore, we feel an urge to make God part of the picture and talk about theistic evolution and all that. But the fact is, if one thinks about what creation means or what a creator means, it's that God has created everything that exists, and therefore I think this is the basic way of getting into the mental atmosphere of believers, right? We believe that God has created everything, therefore you cannot point at anything in the universe that is more God created than, because everything is created by God, right? Like, so you cannot say, oh, this reveals to me, you know, the eye reveals to me that God must have created it. Well, how about the rock? The rock, as much as the eye, is created by, you know, like, we can't reduce God to a part of creation, of the universe, because then it's less than a God.
And we don't think that rock was, you know, kind of designed, like, in a way, you know, that it needs supernatural intervention to happen, no, right?
And then, but we come to the case, you mentioned special creation and the delicate case of the human species, which at least religious claims, which we need to uphold, would seem that there is some special status for us. I don't mean special status in the sense of we stand above, not necessarily, because people always take it as, oh, we are, you know, being mean to other species or anything like that. Not exactly. It's more complicated. We don't have time to get into this. But I know that from your story as a scientist who became more interested in the Catholic faith, you struggle with the idea of miracles and the idea of God's intervention into the world, because we're painting a picture where, okay, God holds everything in existence, he's the primary cause, and then he just leaves the secondary causes to do all the work. But the extra claim Catholics would make is like, yes, but God can also act in the world. How do you manage to reconcile, to come to terms with that idea?
I know that miracles is a kind of a separate subject in a way, but like, if you want me to kind of describe it very briefly, one thing when I, you know, wasn't particularly practicing before my conversion, right, and I was, you know, being trained as a scientist, one thing that I struggled with the faith that I inherited, if you like, was things like, we make certain claims, right, as Christians, about the physical world as well. Things like virginal birth, right? That Jesus was born from a virgin, and there's no physical human father involved in the process of reproduction, if you like.
Yes,
it's like Beccari is like speaking biologically. Just let's take this example alone to picture the idea. So something I struggle with, like, I would say at that point, as scientists, we know that these things don't happen, right? We know that you can't have a viable human baby coming only from a mother without any father involved, right? In the process. So, you know, so I was like, okay, this is basically, you know, impossible, right? But what I didn't realize, when people make this claim, then it's like, you know, we know these things don't happen. What they actually say is, we know that these things don't happen through the natural causes, okay? And that's the actual claim. Now, we can, what we actually propose here, we don't claim that Jesus was born from a Mary in a natural process from a virgin. We claim that there was a supernatural intervention, so from the outside of the natural causes, that intervened in a particular moment. And what happened, what C.S. Lewis talks about, is once you've got this intervention, the rest follows from it naturally. So you've got a set of natural causes after that. We can't pinpoint what this moment was, but then it just follows, right? The natural causes follow from that. Now, as a scientist, I would then say, I mean, before my conversion, it's like, oh, as a scientist, we know that these things don't happen. I didn't realize I was actually saying, as a scientist, we know these things don't happen through natural causes. Now, the question is everything that's happening in the world, is it happening through a natural cause? Does every single event has a natural cause, right? If you think that this is the case, then you're making a philosophical assumption called ontological naturalism, right? Yeah, that there is no supernatural intervention possible. Mm-hmm. So you, at that point, you make a philosophical claim that you know all the events have a natural cause. And for us scientists, it's very easy to slip into that without realizing, because what we do, we use methodological naturalism in our work. So this is the use of empirical tools to find natural causes. This is the proper area of science, right, where you try to discover natural mechanism, find natural causes for natural processes in the natural world, right? So this is methodological naturalism. But then claiming that everything that happens has a natural cause is on the ontological naturalism. And then we can have a philosophical debate whether ontological naturalism is true or whether the supernatural intervention can be possible. And we can have this philosophical discussion, not scientific anymore, right? And in from that perspective, we as Christians believe that the ontological naturalism is not true, that there can be supernatural intervention that can influence the natural causes, right? So in that sense, in this framework, the miracles are possible, as understood as supernatural interventions in the natural world.
That's key, because I think we go back to the question of the continuity between science and philosophy, or the need for philosophy, and the fact that science points towards something that is beyond itself, or that requires its complement in philosophy. And only when you do that work, which we don't have time to go into here today, unfortunately, then you can have a discussion as to whether there's compatibilities or incompatibilities. I would love to have talked about the whole question about human uniqueness and origins and all that, but unfortunately we've run out of time. It's dark outside already. We've been here for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. So we probably can leave this for another podcast episode in the future. Thank you so much for coming. I think there's so much that has come up and that will be of value, I think, for the listeners in trying to get an insight, not just into the whole Catholicism and evolution question, but also into the actual recent research on evolution, which I think is fascinating. And I would love to talk about this more with you in the future.
No, you're right. I think we need to finish off. It's been a long conversation. But I feel like, yes, it's the as always with this conversation, just something else that can be said. But I feel like there's a few points that we might have missed out a little bit that will be important to discuss later on, because you asked me at some point about the struggles, right? The points of conflict or potential conflict. And there's a few more than just randomness and purpose. There's things, the question of a human uniqueness, right? When Darwin himself, he struggled with this idea, because when he realized, you know, the lowly origin of humans, he was actually very upset about this, that we're just nothing more than just animals, and you know, we're just a little branch. And yeah, of course, we don't seem to be any unique from that perspective, right? There are other things that there are points of contention as well. The whole story of Adam and Eve that we even touched on, the original sin.
Genesis.
Yeah, yeah. Like we believe that, you know, first humans were supposed to live on Earth forever, if you like. And then before the fall, before the original sin, where they sinned, the sin brought death into the world, right? Or that before that, there was this idea of original justice, and looking at the evolution, it didn't look like a utopian world at all. Yeah. So there are all other aspects where there is a certain, you know, things that need to be discussed and clarified. So I'll be really happy to come back at some point and, yeah.
Don't worry, we'll record another episode tomorrow. No, I'm joking. Shimon has been extremely patient today because these episodes take a long time to prepare and to record. And I'm very, very grateful that...
I enjoyed it. Thank you so much for this conversation. And I learned something from this as well, because, you know, you're doing philosophy of biology, I'm doing biology, and...
Wow, I mean, I'm not doing philosophy. I mean, I have touched on philosophy of biology at most. I mean, I'm my luckiest, but I don't think I work on that field. But it is a fascinating area. And another point to discuss in the future is actually all the recent developments in... genetic molecular biology that you have been researching, which are not so connected maybe to these things we're talking about.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Okay. The way the latest development in science, mostly in genetics and genomics, we started to sequence the entire genomes, like it gave an incredible window on how the evolution actually proceeded. Because from the fossil record, it's a very patchy picture, right? But genes, the whole genomes, it's just they have an imprint of how evolution happened, and we learned a lot from that, and a very interesting observations. And they also sealed really the evolutionary theory. They cleared many doubts that we had previously about
because
it
showed that we do come from most likely from a common ancestor.
Absolutely,
because it's very unlikely that everybody would have all the
living. And there's excellent examples I would love to share.
Mm-hmm. Well, this and much more look forward to in next episodes of La Encrucijada of the Crossroads. We're going to stop here. Thank you so much again for coming. There will be a long list of references to this episode so people can follow up. And they can follow your interview with Choose Agape, which I will put in the link as well in the description. So thank you for coming today. And we'll stop here at the Crossroads as always.
Thank you.